Thanks, Andy. I appreciate that honesty thing. That goes a long way with me. I'm Jack Mitchell, and I am an alcoholic.
Jack.
I feel a little bit like I'm listening to a Charlie and Joe tape the other day, and they said, it's really neat to stand up and look at such an attractive group of sick people. Anyway, I'm proud to be here. I live in the apartment complex right next door, and I come this way because of the median in the road. I to avoid making a U-turn, when I'm going south, I go north past Howe Place. And you know, it's hard to drive by this building during any kind of reasonable hour, but what there isn't a meeting going on, and a whole lot of cars at a lot of those meetings. And I try to go to as many meetings as possible in different places. This morning I went to my Al-Anon meeting in Ackworth, and I got to tell you, there's an awful lot of clubhouses that would be really proud to have the number of cars in their parking lot that we've got in our parking lot here. We serve a lot of people who need to be served. Okay, if you're up, if it's past your bedtime and you're in a hurry to get out of here, here's my story in a nutshell. I've got a big inferiority complex. I started drinking in college to fit in. I drank too much for too long. I hurt myself. I hurt myself, you know, mentally, and I hurt myself physically. I knew I had a problem, but I didn't know how to quit. Took Ridgeview to show me how to quit, and took AA to show me that there's life after alcohol. Now, if you got a few more minutes, I'll fill in some of the details on that. But you know, when you get all through with it, there's not much more to it than that. On the inferiority complex thing, let me start with that because to me that's kind of basic. What I've done is I haven't gotten rid of the inferiority complex, but I've developed some tools to deal with it so that it's an inner thing, and a lot of people on the outside don't see it, but I'm telling you, it's there, and it's a stone around your neck. I think I inherited the inferiority complex from my dad. Not genetic inheritance, but I think I learned it from him. My dad was short, which for guys, that's right away, it's an uphill battle. And then he was poor as a church mouse. My dad was born in Canada on a farm, small farm, in 1900. His dad, my grandfather, was 62 when my dad was born. My grandfather, not great-grandfather, my grandfather was born in 1838. Just to put a reference on that, that's more than 20 years before the start of the Civil War. And if there's anything that comes of that, I think it is that Scottish people tend, you know, my grandfather died in 1910 when he was 72 years old. Now, in those days, that's a really ripe old age. And I think the moral of the story so far is that Scottish people tend to live long lives. And the hell of it is, they keep on procreating unless they're carefully monitored. my grandfather's third wife, the first two, as far as I'm able, I never, obviously never met them, as far as I'm able to tell, they just died from the rigors of living in a small farm in Ontario back in days when times were tougher than they are now. But in any event, when my granddad died, they sold the farm and they moved to town, Chatham, Ontario. And, you know, in the early 1900s, either in the United States or in Canada, there wasn't much in the way of the welfare support system that we have today. So they, whatever they had to live, I remember my dad telling me one Christmas, The Christmas present for the family, for the kids, was a wood pencil. One wood pencil, and that was it. So he went to school, and he was smart, but he was always behind the eight ball in terms of kind of clothes he wore and all that sort of thing. And that kind of stuff rubs off. I can remember him. I came home from college for Christmas the first year, and he had cut out an article from the newspaper, one of those advice columns that were sort of like an Ann Landers, if you folks remember those kind of things. And he said, "Read this," and I read it. And he said, "What'd you think?" And the point of the article was that people that use profanity. Incidentally, I have an expert vocabulary in profane. Anyway, he said, "What'd you think about that, Jack?" And I said, "Yeah, there's something to it." He said, "God damn it, I knew that was what the problem was." So much for that. I was also spoiled. I don't remember very much about my early life, with one exception, and that is I was 3 years. My relatives assured me that I was spoiled rotten. My dad was 36 when I was born, and they were glad to have children and all that sort of thing. But I remember I was 3 years old. My mother had been gone for 3-4 days and came home with my dad, and they had this basket thing. They call it a bassinet back then. And down in these pink wool blankets was this baby girl. Cute little thing. And it dawned on me, right then, as soon as I saw that, it dawned on me that I was no longer going to be the center of attention for this family. And I was pissed. I was really upset, you know. In any event, this inferiority complex kept after me until I didn't drink in high school. I marvel at the people that I hear stand up here and they start drinking when they were 12 and 13 years old and all that sort of thing. In my high school, there was virtually no alcohol, and I'm going to tell you right here and now, there was absolutely no narcotics. It was a different day and age than the day and age that existed when I brought my kids up, you know, and love to go back to that. But in any event, I started drinking in college to fit in, and I joined a fraternity to fit in. My fraternity... Well, we were known by our best friends as the Drunken Deeks, and hell of it is, we were proud of that. Now, when I say that, what I'm going to say for the next little period of time, I think that the point is that this alcohol thing is insidious. It becomes a way of life, and it creeps up on you. And it gets its clutches into you without you wanting it to or knowing that it's happening. But in any event, we were the Drunken Deeks. Now, we didn't have toga parties and do all the kind of stuff you see in the movies. On a weekend, if we were going to have a party, we put on ties and sport coats. And I'm going to tell you, we consume per man more alcohol than any fraternity on the whole goddamn campus. But we did it, quote, as gentlemen. that was our crowning thing. When we went to football games, we would similarly wear at least a sport coat and a tie, usually a felt fedora hat. And I look back at that and I'm thinking, God, that must have been silly. Here are these kids trying to look like grown-up businessmen. People must have just laughed their ass off at us. But we thought we were really hot stuff, see. If it was a hot day, back in those days, University of Michigan didn't give a damn if you drank a little bit. And so if it was a hot day, We would take one of those metal milk cans the farmers used to use, full of whiskey, on a hot day we'd have, on a cold day we'd have rum, rum and something. A hot day, whiskey sours. And if we had whiskey sours, damn it, we didn't take paper cups to drink out. We took glass stemware into the football stadium and watched a football game, quote, like gentlemen. You know? And it just, the whole damn thing just spirals from there on out. I lived most of my life in nice communities where I got to tell you, if I came over to visit your house after 4:30 in the afternoon, and you saw me coming up the driveway, I would expect you to have a martini ready by the time I got out of the car and walked in your house. See, and so the insidious thing is drinking sort of became a normal thing. And with that normality comes a concept that it's healthy. Go figure that one, you know. When I moved to, I grew up in the area of Detroit, Michigan, where they make cars, used to make cars. Moved to Western Michigan in 1976, and I got a call from my wife that she found this hunting dog. And I invited one of my partners over to look at my new German short-haired hunting dog. God, she was a mangy cur. And I poured him a drink in a little, one of those short on the rocks glasses. And I handed it to him, and he said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, that's a martini." He said, "There's nothing to it." "Really?" I looked in the china cabinet and I found this glass bowl. We got these glass bowls that you serve shrimp in, put ice in, about that big around, filled that up with ice and gin. And he said, "Now that's better." You know? And that was my normal, day in, day out life. And I'm telling you, that just catches up on you. Something really damn bad. Only got one DUI, and frankly, that one wasn't fair. I don't know. But I left this bar restaurant, nice place, and people tell me that the cop was sitting two blocks down the road, and he followed me a mile and a half with his lights out. Until I got to a place where there was a park and there was pretty lights on the lake, and I looked over and my wheel went over the center line, and I was only 2/10 of a whatever over the limit in those days. Didn't think that warranted all that fuss, but should have got one more DUI, tell you the truth. Here's another thing. When people stand up here and they say they're never going to have another drink because of all the misery that they went through when they were drinking, I can't remember most of that. I think part of that is one of the benefits of alcohol is that it screws your memory up. And the other reason I can't remember is because, just frankly, I don't want to. But the one thing I would like to remember is I can remember one night, I remember parts of this night. I remember I was going to stop at this bar to get a Polish hot dog for a late dinner. It's around 9:30. And went in and I had a hot dog. Turns out they serve drinks at this bar. And they serve drinks before you get the hot dog and while you're eating the hot dog and after you're eating the hot dog. They do. And I left out of the bar and it was cold. Now this is up in Michigan. It was around, and my car had cooled down, and it was around 20 degrees. And I don't know if you have that experience down here, but when you go out in a real damn cold like that, your blood goes through your system, and that alcohol just hits you. And I made it about two blocks. And the kind, soul, responsible person I am, I figured, there's no way in hell. I was driving a car all right, but the damn road wasn't staying steady for me. It was apparent to me that I was not going to make it home. And my plan was, here's my plan. I come to the first side street, and I turn off on the side street, and I find a safe spot, and I'm going to take a nap. Not a bad plan. And the only flaw in the plan was I decided to park my car in a nice safe spot where I wouldn't get mugged right under this street light. And that would have been okay if the damn street light hadn't been right in the center of an intersection. And that's where I went. I don't remember that. And that's where I went to sleep. The next thing I remember, I'm sitting in the front seat of this cop car. Front seat, not the back seat. No handcuffs. The window is halfway open alongside of me. My fiance is leaning in. And the cop is saying to her, now, apparently, this is before cell phones. So he had to call Central Dispatch and have Central Dispatch call her to come pick up this drunk. Think about that. Mm-hmm. And he's saying to her, swear to God, he's saying to her, your friend here is a really funny fellow. And I can't tell you how badly I would like to know what was so damn funny that I said to that cop that kept him from running me down to the county building for a night's hospitality. Other than that, I didn't really have I really didn't have that much of a memory problem when I was drinking, because that same fiance, I ended up marrying her. And one of her better attributes, she was very good at reminding me of what I'd done the night before in case I forgot any of that stuff. So memory wasn't all that much of a problem. In any event, life went on, and I kept doing the same damn thing. I never drank. I probably needed to, but I didn't drink in the morning. I was a 5 o'clock drinker, but my I didn't need a clock. I knew my damn stomach told me when it was 5 o'clock. You know, you've all been there. I knew I had a problem. I really knew I had a problem with alcohol for a long time, but I didn't know how to quit, how to deal with it, and I didn't think there was a life after alcohol. It took Ridgeview. Well, back up. Near the end, I do remember the problem keeps getting worse as time goes on. And shortly before I came down here to go to Ridgeview, I can remember I slipped in the bathroom one night. And, you know, I'd like to be able to tell you about all these damn automobile accidents and all that sort of thing, but I don't have that. That's part of my story. But I did slip in the bathroom this one night, and somehow or other, my feet got tangled between the back of the toilet stool and the posts on the wash basin, and I couldn't get them untangled. I got in there. I got to be able to come out, and I worked at that for quite some time. And finally, the normal alcoholic solution for a situation like that is just take a nap. And I did. And I napped for a couple hours. Timed it on my watch. Woke up, still couldn't get the damn feet out. Thought I was fairly sober at this time. Fortunately, I had my cell phone in my pocket. And after struggling for another 45, 50 minutes to get my damn feet out of this hole that they were in, I mean, this is crazy when you stop and think about it. How in the world could a human being go through this kind of crap? I finally called EMS. And I don't know how they got into my apartment without knocking the door down, but I was on the third floor. And they decided not only their mission was not only to untangle my feet, which they did, I mean, they made it seem like a simple thing. They decided I needed to go to the hospital. And they further decided that I wasn't going to walk, you know. So they've got this bag that's suspended between two poles, and they put you in this bag, and a couple, three guys lift up these damn poles, and you'd swear you were in a sack. I mean, it closes in right around you, and down you go like a load of potatoes. I mean, to tell you, that is damn humiliating. But in any event, that's what happened to me. And things like that started to happen with increasing frequency. And it, by the time I got down here, family had a little something to do with it. I wasn't adjudicated. I didn't come because I had to for some court issue. But by the time I came down, I knew that I had a problem and I wanted to do something about it. And I'm really damn, when I look at people that have relapsed that I sit with in these rooms, I'm really glad that I had it figured out in my mind that I really needed help and found places that help was available. It has just absolutely saved my life, and I'm thrilled to share that with you. In any event, I went to Ridgeview, and they kept telling me, Jack, you got an allergy. And every damn time they'd say, you got an allergy, I'd look down at my arm and I'd say, got no rash. You know, what is this allergy thing? The thing that, frankly, the best advice I got at Ridgeview was from four different doctors who were there as patients. Not, they weren't on the staff. This wasn't part of the pitch. And they all said, Jack, if we did an autopsy on you right now, we could show you an area in your brain that is physically different than the similar area in a non-alcoholic brain. There's a physical change that takes place from consuming that much alcohol for that period of time. And I can get my mind around that. I can get my mind around something physical. This allergy thing, this neurosis thing, all this mental stuff, I have trouble accepting that I'm a slave to that. But I can accept that I am a slave to alcohol because my mind is different, and if I have I know damn well if I have another drink, it's Katie bar the door, it's off to the races. Life is not going to be a good thing. And I think the other thing I want to share with you is, I had no idea that you can have a satisfactory social life without alcohol. As I say, I lived in communities where, you know, if you had a party, it was a cocktail party. If you had an open house, the first thing I did was go to the bar. You know, and I think I'll share one other experience that convinced me I was alcoholic. My wife and I drove my stepdaughter over to her girlfriend's house one night, and I hadn't met the guy. Guy was a neurosurgeon, hell of a nice guy. And they invited us in, and he said, do you like Irish whiskey? It turns out they'd just been to Ireland. Well, hell, as long as there's the word whiskey, I didn't care what they put in front of it. I said, yes. And he turned around, and he opened a cupboard and reached up, and on the top shelf is a bottle in a cloth bag. And he takes this bottle down, takes it out of the bag, got out two tumblers, and he poured a couple ounces or so of whiskey into each one of these two tumblers. And he said, how do you like your whiskey? And I said, well, how do you? And I'm figuring, you know, ice and water and all that. And he said, well, I just drink it like this. I said, my kind of guy. Now, here's the part you're going to find hard to believe. So he said that, and I'm settled down in a comfort zone. He said that, and he didn't pick up these glasses and turn around and hand me one. Damned if he's not putting his bottle back in a cloth bag and putting it up on a shelf. And it occurred to me, this is a one-trick pony. Before I ever, you know, people say you cannot have a drink, alcoholic can't have a drink, because as soon as you have another drink, you're off to the races. Hell, I was off to, my concern, before I even got this damn drink in my hand, my concern is, where's number two coming from? I got to get out of here. I got to figure some way to get out of here so I can have another drink. And you know, that's sick. I mean, I worked out in my mind that that is sick. But that's the way my mind was working. And so all of that, you know, those kinds of things started adding up in Jack's mentality. And so when Jack's family finally said, Jack, or Dad, you know, they were right, you know, and I was willing to accept the fact that they were right. And I think that goes a long way. I'm trying to think of some other misery to share with you. I think those are probably the highlights of my career. Claude's fallen off his chair. I think that's my story. I'm proud to be here. I'm proud to be a member of this club. I'm going to tell you that right now. And I'm glad. People say they're glad they're an alcoholic. My life is different. I will tell you. Let me tell you this. My first wife died about 6 months ago. And she was in a hospital down here in a coma on life support. And every once in a while, I mean, every couple of days, she'd open her eye for a little bit. My kids are hovering around her. They're doing everything, telling the doctors to do everything. And she'd open her eye and they'd say, there, see, she's alert. You know, and she had a bed sore on her back that was big enough you could stick your fist in. And after a while, morphine and all those drugs don't deal with the pain. And I'm watching this, and I'm watching my children who are just, you know, doing everything. They think they're doing the right thing, doing everything to keep her alive, keep her going and all that. And at one point, the doctor said, you know, a lot of people wouldn't want to carry on life like this. And it went just right over their head. Finally, the doctor called a meeting for a Monday, and she benevolently died on Sunday night, so my kids didn't have to make the decision to pull the plug. But the reason I tell that story is I watch these people, these kids of mine who don't drink, they don't drink because their dad was such an asshole drinking, but they don't drink. But they don't come close to having the serenity that you and I have. We've got a great gift if we accept it that other people don't have. And I am particularly thankful to have that gift. I wish I could, during the course of this whole thing, I couldn't say anything. I couldn't say, your mother suffered. It would have been wrong, But I think by remaining calm in that kind of situation, some of that serenity rubbed off and was helpful. And I think we can do that service for other people. But we got a good thing going that we should be particularly thankful for. In any event, that's pretty much my story. Anybody wants to nail me on the porch, we can fill in any blanks. But that's it.